Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello and welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast. My name is Steve Schaefer and I'm the director of the Regulatory Transparency Project. We are pleased to have with us today two experts in regulatory analysis who have implemented regulatory modernization in their respective states and who co-authored a May 2024 paper detailing their regulatory reform efforts entitled Regulatory Modernization, Lessons from Idaho and Virginia, which can be accessed on our website at regproject.org. That is regproject.org. First, we're thrilled to have with us Alex J. Adams, director of the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare, and who served as former budget and regulatory chief for Governor Brad Little. We're also thrilled to have with us Reeve T. Bull, who is the director of the Office of Regulatory Management under the Office of the Governor of Virginia, which is Glenn Youngkin. Thank you both for being with us.
Glad to be here.
So to set the table for our audience, why is regulatory reform important? And why did you want to get involved in this space? And how did you get involved in this space? Alex, let's kick off with you.
Well, I kind of got into this not necessarily intentionally. My background was as a pharmacist. I trained as a pharmacist and came from a long line of pharmacists. Dad, Grandpa, and Greg Grandpa were. And what I found is at the state level, pharmacy is one of the most regulated professions. You know, in my state, Idaho, for example, we used to have over 100 pages of regulations, everything about how to store medications, how much square footage pharmacies have to have, is down to as minute details of there needing to be a private bathroom for the pharmacy staff. And it doesn't take very long as a pharmacist to, quickly realize many of the regulations were just, you know, comical and unnecessary. And I always joke one of the fastest ways to have libertarian tendencies is to read your state's pharmacy law. So I kind of got into this just through my experience as a practitioner. And later, when I started working for the government, my first job was running our state board of pharmacy. It's the licensing board that regulates pharmacists, pharmacies, wholesalers, distributors, manufacturers. And I took our regulations down from 100 pages to 20 pages during my three-year tenure. And what I saw is when you cut regulations and reduce that friction on businesses, good jobs follow. We started to see Amazon moving some of their central pharmacy operations into the state. We started to see CVS move some of their central pharmacy operations into our state. We saw new jobs created for pharmacy technicians to work from home. And it was just the classic example. You get the government out of the way, the private sector will fill the gaps, will create jobs, good paying jobs, and bring solutions to the marketplace that can benefit consumers throughout the country, frankly. So through that experience, I really saw the power of regulatory reform. And when Governor Brad Little got elected in 2018, he asked me to come run the budget shop. It's our state level equivalent of OMB, so it oversaw budget and regulations. And I was able to put some of the efforts that we had been doing at the Board of Pharmacy on steroids because we oversaw the regulatory agendas of every executive branch agency in the state. Governor Little, he's seen as one of the red tape champion governors. We are the least regulated state now under the efforts that his administration led. And, you know, we replicated that success of pharmacy all throughout the state. Efforts to increase charter schools, efforts to increase daycare access, all of those have a nexus with regulatory reform. States regulate, it's estimated about 20% of the economy. So there's quite a bit of good work that can be done through efforts at the state level to reduce regulatory friction.
Well, that's fantastic. And Reeve, what about you? Like, what are your thoughts on why regulatory reform is important? How did you end up in this space? What was your career trajectory to be the director, of course, of the Office of Regulatory Reform?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Steve. So I actually kind of like Alex sort of had in my formative years sort of some personal experience with the regulatory state. My father is a plumber and he owns his own business. He does all of his own plumbing work. And so from a young age, you know, I sort of saw the challenges, particularly for in his case, you know, what was a micro business, you know, the smallest of small businesses, trying to navigate, you know, a complicated regulatory climate where there were, you know, federal, state, local restrictions, all of which applied to the work that he did. And frankly, you know, can make it very, very challenging, you know, for a small business to operate. So I ended up going to law school ultimately and, you know, practiced patent law for a while, but eventually kind of found myself doing a lot of work in the regulatory arena. And I think having those formative experiences has always made regulation something that's really, really interesting to me. So I spent a little bit of time in the federal government working on regulatory reform policy. And then when Governor Youngkin created our office, it was really sort of the opportunity of a lifetime to come over here and work on these policies. So I started as deputy director under Andrew Wheeler, the former EPA administrator. And then in March, when Andrew left to pursue a great opportunity, I became the director of the office. And I'd really underscore a lot of what Alex said. I mean, you know, I think it's if you look at the aggregate effect of regulation on the overall economy, it's potentially enormous. People have estimated it's trillions of dollars. I've seen a $2 trillion estimate, a $4 trillion estimate. Regardless of what it is, you're talking about an enormous number. But I think actually in some ways that maybe even underestimates the impact of regulations. And I think the reason why is sort of the experiences that both Alex and I have described that, you know, we've had in our families where for small businesses, it's very, very difficult to navigate. And so I think what you end up losing is a lot of market dynamism, where, you know, large companies, though the regulations can be problematic for them as well, they can easily go hire an attorney, you know, to figure it out and, you know, come up with a compliance plan. Whereas for a small business, it can be virtually impossible to do that. And that's where I think it's important, though it's important to have, you know, restrictions in place, you know, protections. It's also important that it be streamlined and perhaps equally as important that it be transparent. That is something that somebody can pick up, can figure out, and come up with an approach to complying with it, you know, ideally without having to, you know, spend thousands and thousands of dollars, you know, trying to, you know, hire an attorney to navigate this. And I think the results speak for themselves. You know, Alex has spoken to some of the major successes Idaho has had. In Virginia, we were just actually named a couple of weeks ago this top state for business in the U.S. And I think our regulatory reform has been a big part of that. And so I think it gives results, you know, and I think businesses and citizens really appreciate, you know, the value that regulatory modernization can provide.
And Alex, could you explain some of the initial regulatory reform efforts that you were tasked with under Governor Brad Little? So I know that, you know, some of it involves sunsetting regulations. But yeah, could you just explain to the audience what some of those efforts were?
For sure. We had kind of we adapted a saying here that people used to say about gas prices, but I think also applies to regulations. We always say regulations rise like rockets, but fall like feathers. It's much easier to add regulations than it is to get them off the books. And, you know, a large part of what Reeve and I had, you know, spoke about is you kind of need a reduction forcing mechanism. You need something that will compel states to look at what is on the books. Are those the right regulations? Are they still needed? Are they optimized? Are they distorting the labor market? Idaho's approach under Governor Little is called zero-based regulation. It's an obvious twist on zero-based budgeting. Under zero-based budgeting, you're supposed to start every budget cycle anew, presume that nothing was necessary, and then you build your budget around, if we're going to get the highest return on investment, where are we going to put our chips on the table, regardless of if we've done something in the past? Concept's the same for regulation. Just because something's on the books, we're going to look at it anew with a fresh set of eyes and say, and just because it's been on the books doesn't mean it should still be on the books. So, you know, our process was partly designed, partly accidental. Telling it after the fact, it always makes it a slightly cleaner story than it might have been as we experienced it in real time. But, you know, one of the things we did in 2019 was every regulation in the state sunset on a very specific date, July 30th of 2019. And why that was important was regulations that were unnecessary expired by default. If an agency judged a regulation to still be necessary, they had to take action to re-promulgate it prior to that sunset date. And what that did is it flipped the script and it flipped the burden of proof. No longer did agencies have to spend significant time, effort, and energy justifying a regulation they wanted to cut. That was the easy part. They just poof, went away overnight. Instead, agencies now had to justify what they wanted to keep moving forward. So we saw 1,800 pages of rules go away basically overnight. Now none of them necessarily lit the world on fire from an economic standpoint. We got rid of an entire chapter of regulations on a snail that doesn't exist in the state of Idaho. We got rid of regulations on a lottery game show that never aired. Rules for female kickboxing uniforms, just other things that you kind of scratch your head and say, why were those ever on the books? So, I mean, you could debate, you know, was the state economy any freer getting rid of those? And what I would contend is it cleared away the clutter, it got rid of the gunk, and now it shined a brighter spotlight on what remains. And once you get the gunk and you get the what remains down to the important thing, so to speak, now you can spend a little bit more time and energy, and it puts a bigger microscope on those things moving forward. So under zero-based regulation, then the governor took what remained and divided it up into five chunks. It made the agencies go through over the next 5 years and do substantive reviews of those. And kind of the basis for our substantive review is, how do other states regulate this, particularly our surrounding states? And it set a clear expectation that our default should be at or below the least regulated of our neighbor states, unless we had credible evidence to justify why Idaho needed to be more strict. So, yeah, just one example in the paramedic profession, for example. If the amount of continuing education hours we require for paramedics exceeds that of our surrounding states, the default would be whatever the lowest amount of continuing education hours, unless we have Idaho-specific data that would compel us to regulate at a higher level. So, some offhand will say, well, that sounds like a race to the bottom, which nothing could be further than the truth. It's a race to the level of regulation that can be justified credibly by the evidence that is available to us. So what we've seen under zero-based regulation is continued year-over-year-over-year reductions in regulations. This past year, for example, Idaho just reduced another 466 pages of regulations, but more importantly, not just volume, there's quite a bit of substance in there. Charter schools was one of the ones that saw some improvements this past year. Rather than charter schools coming to have to ask for permission to continue every 5 years, it got extended to every 12 years. More time was given for administrators of charter schools, I think from 3-year licenses to 4-year licenses. Charter schools now have the ability to decide if they want to operate as a single local education agency or if they want to continue to operate independently. So there was quite a bit of substance that was tucked into that reduction. And that really is the essence of regulatory reform, not just volume, but substance. But getting that gunk away, clearing it away, attacking what's there, starting with a zero-based philosophy, and then comparing to other jurisdictions and establishing the default of least regulated has kind of been the secret sauce that has worked from Idaho. I do recognize what works here might not work everywhere, and that's kind of the other thing that Reeve and I have highlighted, which is there are many paths to successful regulatory reform. However, the key element, among the key elements, seems to be a reduction-forcing mechanism.
And Alex, what has this new initiative been that Idaho has undertaken to move some regulations into state law? Like, why do that? You know, what's the goal, and how has it worked out so far?
Yeah, so Idaho often is on the front end of trends related to regulations. I mean, my guess is there's been a lot of conversation with Regulatory Transparency Project post-Chevron. Idaho had passed some state-level protections to tip deference away from agencies and more towards individuals that are interfacing with those agencies. And as part of that, there was also legislation that passed that now, as agencies go through their regulatory reviews moving forward, it's nudging agencies to move their regulations into statute. Regulations often started because the legislature had, you know, a broad concept they were trying to accomplish, but didn't have all of the intimate details. They defer to the executive branch to fill in those details. The executive branch does notice and comment. They work with the regulated community. They set specific standards that might not have been known to the legislature at the time that it passed. However, once those are set, what we often found is that those regulations don't change much over time. There isn't a lot of updates. So those regulations could conceivably be moved back to statute. The benefit there is now they're enshrined in law. To change them, it takes an act of the elected body, the elected legislature. So it reduces that bureaucratic temptation to turn those dials up over time, and it creates a more stable business environment that's less susceptible to swings across administrations. What we found, we've run, you know, half a dozen bills that are moving rules into statute. They're passing darn near unanimously with wide margins, but they also serve as a catalyst for even broader regulatory reform. When you take regulations and move them into statute, you don't have to duplicate the definitions. You can cut some of the duplicative content. What we're finding is when you move a regulation into statute, you can cut 70% of the content while still maintaining the overall protection that the regulation was intended to serve. And it also does catalyze a discussion around some of those parameters. Are they set at the right levels? So legislature has established kind of a priority moving forward of looking at regulations that can be moved into statute and moving them into statute to create a more stable business environment over time. I assume you'll see more states doing stuff like that post-Chevron.
Well, thank you. And Reeve, you know, could you explain some of the regulatory reform efforts that you have been a part of under Governor Glenn Youngkin? I know that you're now the director of the Office of ORM, but what, what efforts, have you been a part of? I know that in your paper, you mentioned Executive Order 19. What did Executive Order 19 do, and what was the goal?
Certainly. So, and I think it's very interesting. To sort of hear Alex describe what Idaho has done, which I'm a huge fan of all of the efforts that they put in place. And what's interesting is, Virginia's efforts I think look somewhat different. And I think probably each state would look a little bit different, because there's a certain amount of path dependency. And I think, as Alex said, you can get to sort of a similar result, but sort of how you get there might look a little bit different in each case. And I think in our case, a big part of it was that there were a handful of initiatives that were already on the books. So Virginia has what's called periodic review, where every agency has to go through every 4 years and review its existing regulations. It's not as extensive as the sunsetting provision that Idaho has, but there is at least a requirement that the agencies, revisit the regulations that they have every 4 years. And then in addition, Virginia requires a limited economic analysis for certain implications of regulations. But what they didn't require in the past was a comprehensive cost-benefit analysis. So I like to think of Executive Order 19 as sort of bringing those initiatives together and ensuring that they're comprehensive and represent sort of the whole life cycle of the regulatory process. And I also like to think of it as having sort of two key components. The first is what you do with new regulations, and the second is what you do with existing regulations. So starting with that new regulation component, the main reform that we undertook was that now all regulations in Virginia have to go through a complete cost-benefit analysis. Actually, I should say all regulations and all guidance documents as well, which to contrast that to the federal system, you know, the federal government is a tiny, tiny tranche of regulations. Really only the top 1-2% or so in terms of economic impact that actually undergo a complete cost-benefit analysis. In Virginia, we require cost-benefit analysis of everything. And we really feel like that's been a game changer because it gets agencies thinking in economic terms. You know, as part of the analysis, they have to first ask, do you even need a regulation here? Or is the market able to, you know, fix the problem, you know, to the extent there even is a problem on its own? And oftentimes the answer is you don't need to regulate. But if you decide you do need to regulate, then you need to make sure you're looking at all of the alternatives. You're considering which one is the least disruptive, has the, you know, best benefit cost profile. And then you're actually doing that benefit of cost analysis, actually looking at the economic implications. What's also been interesting is, you know, Virginia, I assume the same is probably true in Idaho and most other states as well. Agencies generally don't have economists on staff. You know, usually, unlike at the federal level, where you have significant numbers of economists, at least at the more regulatory heavy agencies, you don't have that typically at the state level. But what we found is if we provide the guidance that the agencies need in order to do that analysis, that, you know, they're able to do, I think, really pretty sophisticated economic analysis. You know, the analyses we're getting, I think, are very, very good. And they tend to be a lot shorter than what you see at the federal level. At the federal level, you know, they're 500 pages plus long. You need a PhD in economics in order to understand it. You know, ours tend to average around like 10 or 12 pages, you know, give or take. So it's a lot easier for a member of the public to pick this up, understand it, and hopefully be able to contribute, you know, to the dialogue. So we think that's been a game changer in terms of new regulations. Then the second piece of it is existing regulations. And what we did there is we put in place a 25% reduction target for all regulatory requirements, and then also for the length of guidance documents that agencies issue. There, too, we provided extensive guidance to the agencies. What is a requirement? It's a little trickier than one might think, you know, so we had to provide some, you know, some guidance on that front. What counts as a reduction? There, too, it's trickier than you might think. You know, you can cut complete, you know, discrete requirements, but you could also reduce the stringency of the requirements. So, you know, Alex mentioned, you know, reducing training hours and continuing education hours. We've done very similar things at our agencies. For instance, our Board for Barbers and Cosmetology, they reduced their training hours from 1,500 to 1,000. So though they didn't get rid of it, it's a meaningful reduction. It's much easier now to become a cosmetologist. And we give them partial credit for that. That's a third, you know, reduction in terms of the overall burden. And there too, you know, we're finding that agencies are really doing good work. You know, we're finding that they've achieved, you know, major reductions. We estimate around $372 million in terms of savings that we've accomplished. Of that, $322 million is annual. So every single year, you know, those savings will be achieved for new businesses and citizens. So we think it's been a major, major success. Final thing I'll mention on that front, and this is echoing something Alex has said, is that having a central body, you know, like ORM or like the budget office that Alex oversaw is critical. And I think it's the agencies actually, from my experience, they want to do a good job. They are really, you know, they're on board with this, but there needs to be some sort of centralized mechanism to provide that necessary input and to track the overall efforts. I think that's a major reason why Idaho and Virginia have been able to succeed in this space. And I think other states that are looking to do similar reforms, that would be sort of the key takeaway from my perspective, is that, you know, you can create an office like one of ours and you can do so very cost effectively. You know, we're a tiny office of just, you know, a few FDEs. So that would be my sort of, you know, best advice, I feel like, for states that are looking to do this, is create an office to supervise the process.
And what would you say? I know, Reeve, you had mentioned guidance documents that, you know, that the Office of Regulatory Management, you know, oversees, that there's actually a requirement to do a cost benefit analysis for guidance documents. For those who may not be familiar, a guidance document, what is it? And why would the Commonwealth of Virginia require cost benefit analysis of the guidance document?
Yeah, so both great questions. So a guidance document is essentially, if you sort of think of a hierarchy, you know, the Constitution is sort of the supreme law. Statutes that Congress passes are one step below that. Regulations are then issued pursuant to statute, and then guidance documents are one step down. And technically, guidance documents are not binding. The Constitution, statutes, regulations, those are all binding. Those can impose legal restrictions, whereas a guidance document cannot. The idea with a guidance document is you provide additional information to the public, to the regulated community, to help them determine how to comply with regulations. But what you've seen, unfortunately, I think this is especially true at the federal level, oftentimes the guidance ends up becoming more important than the regulations. In some cases, agencies actually will put restrictions in guidance documents. In other cases, they'll speak very, very vaguely in the regulation, and then they'll flesh everything out in the guidance documents. So that's why we thought it was critical that guidance be part of the process as well. And we've been able to ensure as part of this that, first of all, agencies are, you know, to the extent they do have requirements in guidance documents, moving those to the regulation, because that's, you know, the correct way of doing it. And then secondly, that you're considering the economic implications of the guidance. How is this going to affect people? What are the benefits and costs going to be? Because it's every bit as important, you know, in a guidance document as it is in a regulation, especially if it's a widely used guidance document. And then finally, we're also just trying to reduce the length of the guidance documents, because I don't know what the overall page count is. I know that we've eliminated 3.8 million words from guidance documents so far. To put that in context, the King James Bible is 750,000 words. So we've literally eliminated five, you know, Bibles worth of, you know, of words from the guidance documents. And I think that that's really valuable because, you know, think about it from a small business's perspective. You know, again, for to navigate thousands and thousands of pages, it's impossible. It's impossible to do. You would have to hire an attorney to, you know, to read through all of this and, you know, provide the information that's needed in order to achieve compliance. So our goal here is to really simplify it in a way that anybody can get online, find the key guidance documents. They're short. They say exactly what they need to say. They don't have requirements in them. Those are in the underlying regs. And to make it easier for everybody to navigate, we think that that, you know, makes everyone's lives better, including the agencies at the end of the day, because they're wasting a lot of time maintaining things that in many cases weren't even guidance documents. So it removes a burden on them as well.
Stephen, I would add to that. I mean, you know, Reeve's exactly right earlier when he said the path dependency, often what you had in place prior to your administration starts going to depend, you know, is going to drive what you're able to do and how you're able to accomplish it. That said, some of these universal concepts, guidance documents is absolutely one of them. What you don't want to see is a push down on the number of regulations and then they just re-metastasize as guidance documents, because guidance documents don't go through the notice and comment period that regulations do. Arguably, they're less transparent. So one of the things we did in our state, I'm sure others have done, is you know, Governor Whittle signed an executive order, and then it's later been ensconced in our Administrative Procedures Act, making absolutely crystal clear, guidance documents do not create new laws. They only interpret existing laws, and that has to be clearly posted on every guidance document. And then we required every agency to have a central repository of their guidance documents for easy perusal by the public. But you don't want to create the perception of regulatory reform and then have it upregulated through guidance documents. I mean, addressing both simultaneous is going to be probably a critical element, regardless of how a state is going to address these matters.
And Alex, any final thoughts, you know, from your experience leading regulatory reform efforts that other people listening to this podcast should consider, whether irrespective of the state they're in, whether they're in a red state or a blue state, or any thoughts about, you know, your experiences and what may be helpful to them?
Yeah, I mean, many facets of regulatory reform at the state level can be bipartisan. I mean, there's been bipartisan efforts around occupational licensing reform. And frankly, one of the largest sources of regulation that is inherent at the state level is occupational licensing. So this doesn't have to be a red state versus blue state thing. I think, you know, my best advice is anyone that's trying to approach this has to understand the inertia that exists. If effort has to be expended to cut regulations, chances are those are going to be the ones that fall like feathers and just kind of stay on the books for years. If you flip the script and you have a reduction forcing mechanism in place in a centralized oversight body, whether it's a shop like Reeves or whether it's a budget shop like Idaho's, whether it's an OMB like federally, having some sort of centralized body to oversee that, to nudge agencies, to train agencies on expectations, and to make it easier to cut a regulation than it is to keep a regulation, that's going to be the recipe for success.
And Reeve, what would you say? What are some final takeaways, you know, from your experience at the Office of Regulatory Management at Virginia that other people who are interested in regulatory reform should consider?
So the first thing, I would just reemphasize a point that Alex made, which is that, you know, I don't see this as a red state, blue state, Republican, Democrat sort of thing. I mean, we both obviously, you know, work for Republican governors. But I do get the sense that this is really a good government thing at the end of the day. You know, the right and the left may differ in terms of, you know, what the proper level of regulatory protection is. But the vast, vast majority of regulations, you know, the goal should really just be, you know, to achieve something that's justified from a benefit cost perspective and, you know, works in the most streamlined way possible. I think, as a general matter, everybody should be able to agree that that's the overall goal. So my hope would be that, you know, states across the political spectrum, you know, would see the value of this. And I think the results speak for themselves. You know, I think, you know, as Alex has pointed out, this has had enormous, you know, benefits in Idaho. The same has been true from Virginia's perspective, you know, both in terms of our being rated the top state for business. But, you know, similarly, I think the overall ROI, if you will, you know, on the project that we've undertaken has been enormous. You know, we estimate something like $372 million in benefits so far, and the process is still ongoing. You know, the costs are substantially less than that. So I think this is the sort of thing that, just from a good government perspective, every state should be interested in. But the final thing I'd emphasize is if they are interested, then I think it is absolutely critical that they create some sort of office that does this. That centralized oversight, I think, is key in terms of, you know, whether the enterprise succeeds.
And any final thoughts, Alex?
Yeah, I apologize what you're able to hear from me or not, but I mean, the point I was trying to make is this can be a bipartisan effort, and the inertia is such that the default is to keep regulations. So constructing a system to break that inertia and make it easier to cut a regulation than to keep it is what's going to be necessary. A reduction forcing mechanism, a centralized oversight body like Reeve Shop or our budget shop, and, you know, questioning whether or not a regulation is needed as opposed to a statutory amendment is always a good place to start.
Well, thank you both. Thank you, Alex J. Adams and Reeve T. Bull, for sharing your experiences as well as your expertise in regulatory reform efforts in Idaho and the Commonwealth of Virginia, respectively. For more information like this on regulatory reform and regulatory modernization, please check out regproject.org. That's regproject.org. Thank you.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.